The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
After she was sexually assaulted on the Stanford University campus while unconscious, my next guest's life split in two. She became known as Emily Doe, and her assailant served just 3 months in prison. Now she's ready to tell the world who she really is. Today, Chanel Miller reclaims her identity as she shares her story and the aftermath of the assault and trial that followed in her new book, aptly titled Know My Name. Chanel, a very good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Chanel, let me ask you a question that I probably wouldn't have asked somebody in your position some time ago, even in the last 2 or 3 years, and that is this. Are you comfortable talking now about this moment in your life? Are you okay talking about it, or do you fear the triggering of memory?
No, I've actually discovered something quite wonderful, which is that when I would testify during trial, each time the moment in the hospital, waking up in the hospital after the assault was brought up, I would lose complete control over my emotions. I'd begin hyperventilating. I wouldn't be able to see straight. And I'd basically give in to crying until they realized they couldn't go on with questioning and I would be excused to collect myself in the bathroom. That's what happened every time. Now I find that I can remain composed, that I have a very fact-based understanding and grasp of what happened. And I actually get more choked up speaking about what the support and reaction has felt like, because that has been so moving to me. Basically, over the course of processing this, my emotional center has shifted, and I'm really touched by the love I continue to feel, you know, having lived through this assault.
Okay, well then, with that in mind, let's talk about the assault, and I suppose it just puts everything in context. It puts your story in context, it puts your life in context, it puts our conversation in context. So with your permission, maybe take us through as much as you can, and in a way that you're not uncomfortable with, what happened to you. It was 2015, you were 22 years old, and you had graduated already from university, but take us through as much as you can that night.
Sure, I was living at home with my parents. Stanford University is very close by. I had grown up sort of going to that campus for summer camps and lectures, so it felt very familiar to me. My sister, my younger sister, who was in college at the time, was home for the weekend, invited me to this fraternity party with her friends. I decided to go. I thought it would be a very silly event. I'd be the oldest person present. And we went and we were dancing. I was making all these silly, like, juice concoctions. I was dancing like a piece of seaweed. We were having a fantastic time. And I was drinking a lot of hard alcohol with complete disregard for how drunk I was getting, just sort of lost in all of it. And the next thing I know, I wake up in a hospital. It's extremely bright. I have dried blood and bandages on the backs of my hands, and I'm in a gurney. And I turn and see a deputy and a dean of students who come over to me, and the deputy leans over and he says, "We have reason to believe you've been sexually assaulted." To me, he seemed so grave. I thought, they surely have the wrong person. You know, I was just at this ridiculous party with my sister, and I'd really just prefer to go home, but, you know, thanks for letting me sleep it off here. And I was ready to be released, but, you know, they insisted that I get a rape kit done. So I was taken to another room where I had this invasive exam done for the next few hours. And I went to the restroom and discovered my underwear was missing. I had no recall of what had happened. I didn't understand why it was gone. And then next thing you know, they're giving me the morning after pill. They're testing me for multiple STDs. They're prodding me with all these medical devices. I had to strip fully naked. They took photos of my body, which would later be projected in court. And my hair was completely embedded with pine needles. I could not make sense of that. I didn't understand how all of these leaves and scratchy pieces of debris had been stuck inside my hair, and so none of these things were piecing together. And the only thing I was told that morning was that I had been found behind a dumpster and somebody had been caught and arrested. But I didn't understand, you know, why he was caught. I didn't understand why he had run from the scene. And that was never relayed to me.
It is extraordinary because you were going through the demanding motions of what happens to a victim of such a crime.
It's, yes.
You recall it, like it sounds like it's surreal, like you're almost in a movie, in an out-of-body experience in some ways.
Absolutely. I was completely disconnected from it.
And then my next question is this, and it strikes me as though here you are being given all this information, being tested for all these things, and yet oblivious as to what exactly had happened to you. So you had this very peculiar jigsaw pieces that you had to put together bit by bit. How did you do that, memory-wise?
I did not. I sort of blocked it out, and I figured if I just continue to nod my head and agree to everything they're asking of me, they're going to take care of everything, and I'm going to be set right and sent home. And so that's what I did, and I was sent home, and for the next 10 days, I was not contacted by a single person. So I thought, okay, maybe nothing happened. You know, maybe they were just taking every precaution and, you know, nothing had transpired. So I went back to work. I was sort of in denial that I had ever even been to the hospital. And 10 days later, I'm sitting at my desk at work and the headline appears that, you know, this unconscious, intoxicated, half-naked, one breast exposed body was found behind a dumpster, and the assailant had admitted to digitally penetrating me, to groping me. He denied running away. At the same time, he said that I enjoyed it, even though he was not able to recall who I was or what I looked like. And reading that I took pleasure in this, at the same time I was processing that my body had been found so exposed, was something that I could not stomach, was something that was so incredibly suffocating and would be for a really long time.
And on it went, the news reports would come out and you were trying to figure out, so this was me, and you're looking mm-hmm. at reports and you're reading things going, what, who? And they've arrested somebody. I was in Stanford University, which is one of the most esteemed campuses in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And for this to happen, people feel it's otherworldly. It's not the sort of thing that would happen there, et cetera, et cetera. And the name Brock Turner was mentioned. Did you know anything about him? Did you look him up? Did you investigate further?
No, I knew nothing about him. Seeing his photo accompanying, you know, the reports of my assault was the first time I had seen him. And still to this day, I don't really know him. He was just a silent person in the courtroom throughout trial. So it deeply disturbed me that this stranger was claiming, you know, that we had some sort of, you know, friendly hitting off that night, that we had been conversing, that this was a loving interaction, it was a heat of the moment passion type thing, when really he had no idea who I was or what I was capable of.
And now that you know the details, can you piece it back a little bit together? If we go back a couple of steps, what happened to you that night? What did he do, and how were you discovered, and can you give us that sense of the evening in question now that you have the details?
Sure. My sister had briefly left to take care of a friend, so I was by myself at this party. The phone logs indicate that I had been calling my boyfriend repeatedly. I had called my other friend. I had called my sister. So I was trying to figure out where they were. Then there's a period of time where he finds me. He takes me away from the party under his arm. We walk away from the party. He claimed that I slipped and pulled him down on top of me. That's why we were on the ground. He then proceeded to remove my underwear, digitally penetrate me, and two Swedish graduate students happened to be passing by on bicycles. They noticed that he was thrusting a body that did not seem to be moving. So I was unconscious with my eyes closed. They immediately jumped into action. They confronted him, said, "What the F are you doing?" He took off running. One of the Swedish graduate students kneeled down to check that I was breathing. The other one took off, did a leg sweep, tackled Brock, pinned him down, and he was yelling, "Do you think this is okay? What the F are you doing?" And saying, "Apologize to her, apologize to her." And Brock was trying to get away, so the other Swede came, and the two of them mounted him, pinned down his every limb, and made sure that I got medical attention. So even when you have a case as clear as that, where two sober, unbiased witnesses understand the situation immediately, and even when you have Brock, who ran, which exhibits consciousness of guilt, I still had to undergo a year and a half of extremely emotionally damaging court proceedings, a 2.5-week trial, to ultimately end up with a 6-month county jail sentencing for the 3 felonies of sexual assault and intent to rape that Brock was convicted of.
The court proceedings, as you've just mentioned them, seem to cover a lot of things other than the crime of rape. Do you know what I mean by that? It seemed to cover talk of consent, of alcohol abuse, if you like. And it seemed that the fingers were pointing in the wrong direction vis-a-vis culpability.
Correct.
And can you tell me about that? I mean, did you find yourself going, why are you asking? Because they had to, in some ways, a defense attorney needs to reduce you in the eyes of a jury. Emotionally, physically, whatever it might be, intellectually. Is that what happened in this case?
Absolutely. In court, you feel completely stripped of identity. You feel constantly exposed. When you try to give testimony, you're constantly interrupted with objections. The defense is there to remind the jury of how much you drank. He asks you how much you drank in college. You know, how many times have you blacked out? As if this is relevant to this case in which the perpetrator made a decision to violate my body. And so often we use alcohol to blame the victim and dismiss violence and rationalize violence and make excuses for the perpetrator, when really, I don't care how drunk you are. It is never okay for somebody to hurt you. It is never okay for someone to touch you without your permission. And the suggestion that, you know, that I had been reckless, that meant that I deserved this, would never be true. And, you know, since I did not have memory, I watched as Brock sort of filled in the testimony and, you know, took every liberty to fill in that story, to paint it how he wanted it to be seen. You know, that night after he was arrested, he never mentioned that there was any dialogue between us. And during trial, he was on the stand and they asked him if there had been consent. And he claimed that he had literally asked if he could finger me and that I had explicitly said yes. All of this seemed to come out of nowhere. And so in a courtroom where you think people are bound to the truth, I watched so many things get distorted while I was overridden and silenced.
And were you slightly hamstrung in any way, Chanel, by the fact that you had blacked out, and that the cards were in his hand, so he could say this happened, this happened, this happened, and then you weren't in a great position to say it didn't? I'm not having a go at you by any means, but I'm just asking you about the process.
Yeah, you feel like, oh, well, maybe, you know, I didn't defend myself properly, when really, at the end of the day, I was not assaulted because I had too much whiskey. I was assaulted because he made a decision that night to assault me, and that will forever be the case. And it's very fascinating to me that, you know, immediately when I was interviewed by the detective, I was transparent about how much I had had to drink. I laid it all on the table. I was never, you know, trying to hide any of it. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, I threw back these shots. I did it without chaser. I don't know what I was doing. And I felt like crap the next day. Mm. But you don't have to tell a victim, oh, maybe you should drink less. Trust me, she knows this. You need to tell the perpetrator, you don't get to touch her. I don't care about the circumstances. That is never, ever your right.
The perpetrator, Brock Turner, the media seem to have a kind of peculiar fascination with him, his status, if you like, in society. Could
sure.
you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, he was operating under an immense amount of privilege, which to me means never having to examine yourself, never having to step back and think about what your actions mean to other people, to be so insulated in your own experience, to never have to think about what it would mean for me. And I think it's interesting that in the criminal justice system, you know, when you have a perpetrator who's a person of color, they're more likely to be demonized, to be seen as dangerous, to be labeled as a criminal. Whereas for him, he was so humanized. We treated this as, oh, this was just a slip up in behavior, that this was just a lapse in judgment, but it's not who he is. He's still, at the end of the day, a model citizen who lost his way and needs some guidance back. But I watched this protection around him as the court proceedings happened, and this deepening of empathy for all of his losses of status, for not being able to attend Stanford, for not being able to be on the swimming team. And meanwhile, I was sort of this side character. I was nothing more than the body that was found behind the dumpster. So my inability to exist as a person and his ability to exist as a full human who, you know, has hopes and dreams, who has childhood memories, who has so much at stake, that juxtaposition was stunning to me.
I just want to mention it as you're talking, the fact that your book, by no accident, I suspect, and by total design, has this black and white design. You know, the top half is black backdrop to the white words, know my name, and then there you are, your name in black print, Chanel Miller, on a white backdrop. And I'm thinking then, of course, of the resurrection of the case of the Central Park case all those years ago, which is now in the TV show Now You See Us. And it brings up that sense of the judicial system and the black and white factor and race in some ways. You think we would evolve as a species, but it seems we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, we're a little slow.
We're a little slow at that point. You were Emily Doe. Isn't that what the name they gave you as the anonymous figure in the courthouse and the courtroom? At what point do you decide? I mean, is it an epiphany? Is it a cathartic moment where you say, I am sick of being in the shadow. I'm not the body at the dumpster. I am a human being. And I won't be out-humaned or humanized by the guy who did this to me. Was that a process or a moment?
Definitely a process, because you fear that you will be branded, right? That this will overshadow the rest of your life, that you will never be able to build yourself beyond this act of violence, and that you will forever be trapped in that story. And for a while, I was so bitter. I had just graduated. I felt like I had my whole life ahead of me, and now I felt like I was stuck in this case, that I could never be anything more. And that was really terrifying sometimes, that sense of hopelessness, of not being able to be who you want to be in the world. And I think as I was writing, I was beginning to realize, as I came to the end of writing the book, that when you look back, the experience of this assault is major and it's formative, at the same time, it is only one of so many experiences in my life, and being able to incorporate it into the rest of my life was really healing. I think I've finally accepted, fine, you know, this will be a huge part of my life and how the public knows me, but I get to decide what role it plays. I get to decide who I am in this case. So now I emerge as an author. I emerge as someone who refuses to be silent and has, as a result of going through this, is now more assertive and more confident that I'm not just emotionally damaged and this broken person, that I have figured out how to grow and fill myself out as a human, and also make sure that we continue to humanize survivors, to say we are not just statistics, we are not the nameless, anonymous Emily and Jane Doe's in these cases. We are people surrounded by people who love us, and we have our own desires and talents. We have so much to offer, and it infuriates me when we let that get suppressed, when we let victims go off into their corners to mull over the things they did wrong, to dwell in their shame, and we don't do enough to rescue them from that, to say, no, you deserve a full life. You deserve to be right here, and we will fight for you as you find your way back to living.
Let me light on a word you use there, because it's swimming in my head in light of a few interviews we've done on this program and on a TV show recently with people who are victims of the most heinous crimes, mostly sexual crimes. And the feeling is, when they talk in the way you've been talking to us today, Chanel, is that shame belongs to the perpetrator, but for far too long, the victim feels that. And ultimately, the only answer to this, in a psychological, metaphorical sense, is that every victim of a crime like this needs to hold a mirror and reflect that shame right back on the person who committed the crime, because otherwise it's not fair.
Exactly. There's a point where I hope you say, it's not my turn to carry this burden anymore. Yeah. It's your damn turn, right? And so often shame is ingested. It is taught throughout the criminal justice system. You know, I learned so much about having shame about all different parts of my life, and you let it fester, you let it sit there and grow and eat you from the inside out. And we need to be able to extract that from survivors and say, no, this is not yours to carry. This should have never happened to you.
You say the shame loves growing in a contained environment.
Yeah.
Like a tomato in a glass house. But but the key to that is, bring some stones in your pocket and break the glass.
I've never heard any of these metaphors.
I just made it up.
Really low.
But it just feels right as we're talking.
Shame is like moldy tomatoes in a glass house. Something about stones in your pocket.
Stones in your pocket. Amazing. Break the
stones
windows.
And
let it out.
I love that.
You know, it's not right.
That's right. We're giving people stones as we continue to speak.
It's true. You're arming the people who shouldn't be in the glass house. Now, it's going to get out of control, this metaphor, so I'll stop now. But you know where I'm coming from, don't you? You know where I'm coming from. You said you get to use your anger as fuel. Would you rather have less anger? And if so, does that mean you have less fuel? Or can you transplant the anger and put something else there instead?
Oh, no. I think anger can be really wonderful. I think more of us should be mad. When you see someone you love crumble from something like this, when you watch this bright person who was previously so excited about the world begin to withdraw, I want you to boil. I want you to say, I will not allow this to happen. You know, you deserve so much love and safety in your life, and I will use anger to fight for that. You know, I think the anger in the beginning was crippling because I couldn't do anything about it. But I also realized, like, for so long in the beginning, I was basically mute. I couldn't talk about my story, and I kept everything so suppressed. As the case went on, as I began to feel more and more anger, as I began to see what the case was doing to my younger sister, who was forced to be cross-examined on the stand, who was also attacked, anger was a sign that I was finally stepping onto my own side. You know, that I was finally drawing a line, that I did have personal boundaries and it was not okay that they were being crossed. So anger was that little flame that let me know that I wasn't just going to wither away. It's what was going to bring me back as a person and allow me to begin fighting again. So even, you know, for each interview I go into, mm-hmm. I remember, you know, someone I know who has been hurt by this. I feel that little, you know, match striking of anger, and that's how I carry myself and get through and remind myself of purpose.
Where's Brock Turner today, Chanel?
I have no idea, yeah. But I know that he, you know, finished probation mm-hmm. after 3 years, only served 3 months in the county jail, and, you know, I continue to focus on my own trajectory and remind myself that I'm here to help others, that this is not some revenge, whatever. I think people think, oh, she's coming forward in order to go after him, when really that purpose would never get you anywhere. I could never conjure enough energy just to get back at him. I have to be here to fight for others, to protect others. And for him, I guess I just wish that he will one day choose to really hear what's happening, to really reflect on it, to grow from it. Life is really long, and to live in your own deluded bubble, to, you know, to never acknowledge harm you've caused, that has to hurt him too in some way. So I don't know, one day.
The Swedish students who pinned him down and got him off you and mm-hmm. rescued the moment. There's three words you've used in your book and or in conversations in recent times that I love, because I think for men in particular, whether it's on campus, it's on the street, or in the home, be the Swede.
Be the Swede.
Be the Swede. Stop it, talk about it, report it, but don't walk past it.
Totally. Confront it. You know, if you see someone being disrespected or hurt or devalued, say something. If you're silent, that's your own stance, you know. That's choosing not to do anything. So
silence makes you complicit.
Exactly.
I think. I mean, especially in terms of what we've been discussing today. It's no longer good enough to be silent or to be passive.
Correct.
So you started off life as Chanel Miller. And your name and your identity was effectively robbed from you from this incident. And you became a shadowy figure called Emily Doe. Yeah. And then you went through hell and you came out the mm-hmm. other side. Is it safe and fair to say that Chanel Miller is alive and well?
Oh, yes. And I have so much to continue to enjoy in my life and give and create. And I really look forward to that. And I'm very proud of myself for having been through it all. And I just feel grateful for all the people I continue to meet. And I'm proud of fellow survivors for wherever they are in their journey. I'm proud of you if you get up in the morning and drink enough water. That, to me, is strength. So keep going wherever you are.
Chanel, thank you for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Important book you've written, and appreciate it.
Thank you, Ryan. It was lovely speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Chanel Miller is the author of Know My Name, which is a book for some of us, but a manual for those, I have no doubt, and it's a book you'll want to read. Right, the text number is always 51551.